information on each of 3,000-plus counties in the U.S., including 550 high-resolution full-color maps and full-color photographs, as well as detailed information and analysis to help you zero in on the best places to live, the ideal location for cabins and vacation homes, as well as safe and unsafe areas. Get Prudent Places USA for only $29 plus shipping by calling New Millennium at 888-803-4438. That's 888-803-4438 to order on the web or at Berkey Water.
Are we coming through all right? Okay, thank you. Well, this is Dr. Stan here at Radio Liberty, coming from the hills overlooking beautiful and picturesque Monterey Bay, and bringing you the news behind the news, the story behind the story, hoping to convince you that reality is usually scoffed at. And, of course, that reality is usually scoffed at, that illusion is usually king. But in the battle for survival of Western civilization, it's going to be reality, not illusion or delusion, that'll determine what the future will bring. And I have to remind you the views that are expressed here are not necessarily those of the owners, management, staff, sponsors, or supporters of the station you're listening to. They happen to be my views, and for the next hour they're going to be the views of Mr. Robert Messick, and we're going to be talking about his book, Bullets of the Border. Did I pronounce your name right, Robert?
Yeah, I'm Dr. Stan. How are you doing?
I'm doing just fine. And Robert's written a fascinating book about his experience when, of course, he was picked up going across the border into Mexico and actually arrested and thrown into prison because he had a box of cartridges in his car, and he had just been doing some target shooting, left the bullets there inadvertently, hadn't even thought about it. He was on his way to visit his parents, and who were staying at a timeshare in Mexico, and I'm going to let Robert tell you this incredible story. Go ahead, Robert.
Yeah, thanks for having me on. I really appreciate it. Yeah, quite literally a silly situation. I was just had a couple of days off work, and I was scheduled for vacation. And my parents, my dad was had a week at timeshare in Mexico. So one evening, I decided to real quick drive down for just a couple of days to rendezvous with him. And I went from Arizona and crossed towards Rocky Point, Mexico, and real briefly stopped at the Mexican border and neglected that I had a box of target shooting bullets in my car. So a simple privilege that we have in the United States changed into a dramatic fiasco for me crossing into Mexico.
All right, fine. And of course, you had no idea that you were really doing anything wrong at all. You didn't mean to do anything wrong. You stopped at the border, and then, of course, you're taken in, and you're questioned, and then this drags on and on and on. And, you know, of course, they keep telling you need a lawyer.
Yeah.
Well, I had this sort of feeling that the lawyers were working in sort of cahoots with the authorities there. And of course, if they can get a gringo and they can get the charge against them, no matter how ridiculous, why, the lawyers come out pretty well.
You know, that was interesting. That is correct. You know, we'd always, you know, my family had traveled to Mexico beforehand, and, you know, we were tourists beforehand, and if you know, the border patrol sees a group of family crossing the border, you know, they'll wave them on. But for me, I was you know, coming down later in the evening time. I was by myself, single, you know, male American, driving, and so it looked just a little bit more suspicious. And so ultimately, I did go from the border patrol and was given over to the local police station. And the very funny part about it was these policemen that were in this jailhouse locked me in, and I said, okay, so what's next? I thought that I was going to be seeing a judge, and it was getting kind of late, and the guy looks at me and he says, do you know a good lawyer? And my first thought was, wow, these guys have seen a little bit too much of American movies. And I said, well, I don't need a lawyer. I just wanted to see the judge and get this resolved. He looks at me in the eye and says, you're going to jail, and you need a lawyer. And he walks away. And so I finally surrendered to the idea that I was going to spend an evening in the jail, and then the next day I did find a lawyer that came to my aid.
Of course, and did it really cost you $5,000 for the all the hearings?
Yeah, the lawyer's fee was $5,000 for us to for them to take a look at the case, and then they came to me and said, "We want to give your car to the judge," who was eventually ultimately kind of making the decision. And so you never say a bribe, but it was a gift. We want to give a gift of your car to the judge.
So, but did you give it?
Yes. Yeah, we
did. Hold that thought. We'll be right back.
You got it.
Well, this is Dr. Stan here at Radio Liberty, coming to the hills overlooking beautiful and picturesque Monterey Bay. Our guest this afternoon is Robert Messick. He's written a fascinating book called Bullets at the Border. And, of course, we often will complain about our legal system with good justification. But when you compare it with that legal system in Mexico, why, the system that we have is really certainly lily white and almost perfect. Because what happened to Robert was he went across the border. Why, he was a young, white, single male going across the border late at night, and they thought he might be taking in drugs or something, or contraband, and so they looked at his car, and they found a box of target bullets. He had been target shooting in Arizona, where he lived, and he had left this box of bullets in the car without ever thinking about it. So he gets arrested. They put him in jail. And, of course, eventually they have to bribe the judge. He has to give his car. It's not a bribe. He just gives his car to the judge as a sign of just goodwill. He has to pay his lawyers $5,000, who seem to be working in cahoots with the police. But you get a feeling of just this total corruption in the Mexican legal system, where one hand washes another. Did you have that sort of feeling, Robert, as you were suddenly entangled in this, and day after day after day you're in prison?
Yes and no. I will say it felt more like the cops and robbers of the 1920s. And, deep down inside, they were people too. And obviously they were trying to do a good job with what, resources they had. But it just seemed a little bit more archaic than the laws or the regulations that we have in the United States.
But, actually being forced to give the judge your car,
mm-hmm.
I mean, doesn't that sort of smack of bribery?
It does. On the flip side, we were tempted to say, well, if this doesn't resolve it, then we were thinking about going, my friends and my dad eventually said, well, we were thinking about going to Phoenix and contacting the TV stations to do an emergency newscast around this, and that would really shake up the tourist industry. So it was a little bit of hardball on this as well.
But, of course, you ended up losing your car. You ended up losing $5,000 for the lawyer's fees, of course, and the lawyers were going to represent you. But here you are. You don't speak the language. You're trapped in a legal system you don't understand. The judge makes the final decision, and he finds in your favor after he gets your car. And so we're going to be back here in just a moment with Robert as he develops the experience that he had. And I think all of us should think of what it would be like to be arrested. Well, this is Dr. Stan. And so, Robert, why don't you tell us about your time in prison? Because this was really a learning experience, wasn't it?
It was. I actually spent time in two jails. Eventually 9 days total, and the first jail was on the border town. I had been passed over from the border guards into kind of the local jail system, and I was in a cell about 8 feet by 8 feet by myself. It was kind of later at night, so it was a quick put in there, and then we'll deal with it tomorrow. And as I'm in the jail, around me, it's pretty skimpy. You hear nightmare stories around, Mexican jails, and your mind runs wild around what am I going to do with myself. And it's in the middle of December, and northern Mexico can get kind of cold, especially in the desert. And in front of me, the one lesson that I really really enjoyed was, or really made a significant difference to me, was that in the corner there was two blankets. And they were dusty and probably looked like they had better days. And my thought was, okay, I can either stay awake cold and miserable, or I can figure out if there's any bugs in the blankets, and eventually I kind of shook the blankets out and stayed my first night in the jail with trying to get a little bit more warm.
Well, because it's really a rather frightening experience. You're in a country where you don't speak the language, and Sydney, for our listeners out there, it's one thing, of course, to go to a tourist center in Mexico, and it's all beautiful and very, very modern, but you get out into the hinterlands of Mexico, you never know what you're going to get into. And, of course, once you run afoul of the law, they can make your life miserable, end up with your money, end up with your car, but you didn't even know if you were going to get out of prison. I think with that, after a few days, after 3 or 4 or 5 days, weren't you beginning to wonder, am I ever going to really get out of here?
That was the question, and I eventually came to the Rocky Point Jail after day number 3 or 4, and the Rocky Point Jail was with a lot more inmates, all of them Mexican, and the jailers were nice. They, you know, everyone's kind of curious around, you know, this gringo in jail, and yeah, every day I had the attitude that I would be being released either today or tomorrow. Tomorrow I've got to be released. And every evening when the jailer locks us up, he says, "Good night, Roberto. Maybe you go home tomorrow, but tonight you sleep well." And so it kind of gave me a little bit of hope in saying, okay, tomorrow at least I've got to get out. And it kept on for quite a couple of days.
And, of course, one of the interesting things was, of course, the other inmates down there. And, of course, mm-hmm. There's certainly a fear that, you know, you don't know what's going to happen when you're there with these people, and how many of them are hardened criminals, how many of them might, we hear the stories, of course, in our own jails where there's stabbings and rapes and all sorts of things that go on in American prisons, and what's going to happen to you in a Mexican prison. So would you like to tell that story? Because I thought it was really, really so interesting.
Yeah.
Your thoughts, you know, and your thought process, and then what happened.
You know, it's amazing around that. A lot of people do hear really bad stories, and most, you know, many of them are true. The second jail that I went to is the Rocky Point Jail, and when I went in, I was kind of put in the jail with my sleeping bag that I had, and a bag full of clothes, and almost all at once, a couple of Mexicans came and kind of circled around me and was looking at me and things like that, and literally I found myself my back to the wall, and I didn't know what to do, or, you know, if I turned wrong, someone would kind of jump me. And all of the emotions kind of coming up, and this was kind of the climax of the moment, is what am I going to do? And one guy came up to me, and he kind of spoke broken English. He was a little bit younger man, so he knew both English and Spanish. And he asked my name, and I told it to him, and he says, "Hey, we're all friends here." And I asked what he meant by that, and he said that a local church brings in food, and it's only temporary. Most of them would be there for about a week before they either went to a state prison or were released on whatever charges. And he says, you know, we're all friends here, and we might as well make the best of it. And in a moment, my attitude shifted, was rather than them thinking of, you know, doing malicious intent to me, it was more that they were curious of me. And so my attitude shifted towards them, and it made the world a difference around, okay, I can actually interact with these guys and try to figure it out and, you know, make the best of it.
And first, really, your impression of the people you met in jail, both the prisoners and the, you know, and the people who were the guards and the wardens, they were really pretty decent people all in all, weren't they?
Usually so. You know, I didn't have any problems. The jailers were nice, and as I mentioned, you know, the jail that I was at, the jailers actually had their, you know, wives come in a couple of times and sweep, or you see an old lady sweeping or things like that. And actually there was a sense of community or family, and almost seemed like a family business that everyone would help out. Similar with the inmates, a lot of family members would come and, you know, meet people at the front gate and kind of hold fingers or hold hands through the bars and talk. And, you know, I felt that same way with eventually with, you know, most of the guys that were in there.
And of course your father was actually staying at a timeshare in Mexico, and you were able to reach him, and of course he came to the prison to try to get you out. You want to talk a little bit about your dad? He sounds like a nice guy.
Yeah, you know, obviously thinking of, you know, me rendezvousing with him, imagine a father that's waiting for his son to join him for vacation, and I'm a half a day late by then. And the funny thing about it was the lawyer, the first jail, the lawyer came up to me and says, "I'll be your lawyer." I said, "Well, maybe you have to get an answer from my dad. Go find my dad at the hotel," which was about an hour away. So that was actually the mechanism that I used to get my dad informed that I was in trouble. So imagine some, you know, Mexican lawyer knocking on my dad's hotel door saying, "I'm a lawyer and your son's in jail." Just, you know, does my dad believe him or does my dad not believe him? And either way, it doesn't sound good.
And, of course, the thing is, the other thing they told him is they wanted $5,000 to represent you, which is a lot of money in Mexico. But they probably figured you were a rich gringo and they were going to get everything they possibly could. And yet they seem to at least have done the right thing by you as far as getting your hearing eventually. And, of course, you had no choice. You had to have them as lawyers.
Yeah, Dad was smart. He said, "Okay, that's fine." And you know, obviously, they had me over bail. What do I do if I say no? He gave a cashier's check half up front, and then he says, "Okay, half afterwards when my son's released." He says, "If you give him, you know, all up front, there's maybe a risk of additional fees or additional challenges." So it was a really smart idea to do half and half.
And then he really was, of course. But then, of course, the days began to drag on, and every day there seems to be another problem that's coming up. And the judge who was supposed to see hear your case, wasn't he away for a part of the time?
Yeah, the first jail that I went to, the local judge actually didn't want to deal with it. So that's why I went to ultimately the Rocky Point Jail. And it was around Christmas time, and so the judge that actually was supposed to look at it actually went on vacation, and he assigned the secretary to be the decision maker for it. And so ultimately that was the person that we were working with for trying to say that I was a good enough guy and to allow me to be released.
And, of course, the thing is, apparently, why, of course, people aren't allowed to have guns in Mexico, and of course, the bullets, of course, if you had bullets, they figured you had a gun, or you were taking the bullets into somebody who did have a gun. Was that it?
Yeah, and, had I had the handgun with me, it was, packed away, safe and secure in my home, and had I had the gun, it would have been, a couple of years probably in the making, being in challenge. But just a box of bullets, when the Border Patrol found them, they said, "Okay, so where's the gun?" I said, "I don't have a gun. It's away, at my home. So why are you bringing bullets?" they asked. And I really couldn't get an answer other than, "I'm sorry, I didn't mean to do this." And, they did think that I was going to kind of resell bullets. And I really didn't have a proper vocabulary to say. I really didn't have the intention of, creating problems.
Oh, but of course, this was basically what it was all about. They had the rules, they had the regulations. You had bullets. Bullets are illegal for anybody to have.
Yeah.
You were not a citizen. You had bullets. Why, you were going to have to go to jail, or at least be evaluated by the judicial system. And once you got into the judicial system, why, it's simply delay after delay after delay. Now, here in the United States, we have something called the right of habeas corpus. You can't put people in prison. You just keep them there. They have a right at least to a hearing so that you can actually appeal your case before a judge. But down there, they don't have the right of habeas corpus. Here in the United States, we have the right to have weapons. It's being constantly infringed by those who would establish a dictatorship, but the Second Amendment still exists today.
Mm-hmm.
There are people that like to do away with it. There are people that like to do away with freedom. There are people that like to be able to search you and have you have a chip in you so they can track you and listen to your telephone conversations and read your emails and read your faxes and certainly know everything about you so they can control you. But here you are down in Mexico, not used to this sort of thing. And there, of course, you're trapped in a system that you just don't understand. So what about your girlfriend? What part did she play in this whole story?
Yeah, I left my girlfriend going down on vacation. I said goodbye. And when I hadn't shown up for my dad, he called my girlfriend. And just imagine, a dad calling saying, "Where's Robert?" And the girlfriend doesn't know. He left me last yesterday. And so imagine all the panic that you have with that. And eventually Dad called her again saying, well, we found him, but he's in trouble. So, she was a sweetheart. She really supported me, and she actually got letters of recommendation from, you know, leaders in the community, my manager and other people, and actually brought them down eventually to show off to the secretary around that.
And you were in financial management?
Yeah. I was a stockbroker at the time, advising on management, or advising on investment. So it was interesting to, you know, have some regulatory challenges, but, you know, when I came back, I had to report that I got arrested in Mexico.
Hold that thought. We'll be back here in just a moment. The book, Bullets on the Border, by Robert Messick. Well, Robert, how was the food in the Mexican jail?
It was interesting. The first jail that I went to, some guy came up to me during the morning. He says, do you want to eat? And I said, yeah. And so he came back about 15, 20 minutes later with a handful of tortilla and meat and a lime, and I made a kind of little tortilla sandwich out of it, or a little taco. But the fun thing about it is first day, he handed me a can of Coke. And I was thinking, well, I can either eat it, you know, drink the can of Coke now, or I can, you know, do it later. And I, you know, said to myself, I made a conscious decision that I was going to not open the can of Coke until after I left the jail. And so I had a can of Coke in my possession for the 9 days. The second jail, the local church passed in food, and it was a sense of community. Everyone had an opportunity to eat. And it was kind of interesting. Even every evening, one person kind of volunteered, or you know, somebody said, hey, it's your turn, you know, make dinner. And one person actually made dinner for all of us. They had a small electric fry pan, and usually the church passed in either, you know, tortillas or bread of some sort, and meat, maybe some vegetables, and so they'd fry up the vegetables and meat and pass it around. So imagine, you know, all of us getting locked into a cell, and this guy passing around a dozen, you know, handfuls of meal. And it was actually interesting. I thought to myself, well, this can be probably the most authentic Mexican food I'll ever eat in my life.
And it really was. But I think it's very interesting that the churches down there would come into the prisons to provide the food, because I'm sure that they don't have a lot of money down there. Of course, they have a few billionaires down there. They have more billionaires in Mexico than all the rest of South America put together. And so what you really have in Mexico today is a two-tiered society. A very small number of very wealthy people. In fact, it's said that the richest man in the world is in Mexico. Whether that's true or not, I don't know, but he's got to be pretty rich. And then, of course, you've got a military and you've got a police force. And you have a very small, relatively small middle class. And then you have this great mass of very, very poor people who are constantly oppressed, who really can't get ahead. Because, of course, even if they were farmers, why, of course, then we passed the NAFTA Act so we could actually flood Mexico with subsidized corn from American growers. So we subsidize our corn, we ship it to Mexico, so the Mexican peasant farmer, can't sell because he can't compete with our prices, because we subsidize, our government subsidizes the corn that we send to Mexico, and it impoverishes the people there ever more. But, you know, the feeling I got reading your book was that you really had a lot of empathy with the other prisoners who were there, that most of them seemed to be pretty decent people who were really sort of working together and helping one another. Is that right?
Yeah, that was. You know, on the topic of food, the Rocky Point Jail was split into two sides. The one that I was on with the people that had gotten in trouble and, you know, temporarily going to be there, and on the other side was, I'm going to say, what I consider a drunk tank, and people would come in there. It was a large room with cell, you know, a wall of cell bars, and, you know, they'd probably leave within a day. And I remember for breakfast they gave us oatmeal, and I remember I really didn't like the oatmeal. It tasted like grits, and I just couldn't eat oatmeal. And I remember...
Hold that thought right there, Robert. We'll be right back. Well, this is Dr. Stan, and Robert's book, Bullets at the Border, really is, of course, his odyssey, this 9 days that he spent in a Mexican prison. But of course, what he really found is there were an awful lot of good people there. They may have been in prison for whatever crimes they had committed, but of course there was almost a feeling of wanting to help one another, and there was certainly a great deal of help. Of course, the local churches brought the food in, because the Mexican government doesn't have much money. They don't have an income tax like we do, or certainly for the general population. And so they don't have enough money to pay their people and provide food, so the local church brings the food in. But what was so interesting is, you know, instead of having cooks and all the things we have in our prisons, why, the people cooked their own food and passed it out. And go ahead, tell the story there.
Yeah, I was saying that for breakfast they gave us oatmeal in addition to like a banana and a roll. And I ate the banana and the roll, but I couldn't eat the oatmeal, and I actually gave it away to a couple of people on the other side of this jail that was in a drunk tank. And just, you know, seeing them, that, you know, longingly look over to our side, and, you know, seeing handfuls of food, and I passed it over, and it kind of became a habit for me, you know, for the morning times, to give this oatmeal away, because I really, you know, couldn't eat it, and, you know, it was useful to somebody else. You know, you mentioned a couple of things around a sense of kind of belonging or friendship, and the one thing that I realized is that most of them were there because they had gotten in trouble. Most of the inmates that I was with were either drug trafficking. One was a coyote, and they'd gotten in trouble for one thing or another. But interesting, it was almost a sense of that they were trying to make, and they were trying to survive even with the things that they were doing. In other words, they had no sense of right and wrong, that, you know, the drug dealer, the drug trafficker, still had to, you know, make money just as much as anybody else. And so it was interesting, you know, the morality was different. I was even offered a job. They said, Robert, we want you to meet us, you know, in Tucson and, you know, take a trunk full of marijuana or drugs into Mexico. And I said, well, how much do you get paid? And they said, well, on, you know, three or four trips, it was worth my annual salary. And so I said, well, it's nice, but I just didn't have the morality to say yes. And so it was interesting that their focus was more along the lines of survival and making money with something that worked, let alone, you know, forget if it was right or wrong.
And of course, the thing is that the people there are really, many of them are desperately poor. And that's why, of course, many of them come across the border looking for jobs here, because, of course, we've impoverished their country by the NAFTA, opening up the NAFTA Free Trade Agreement, which has allowed us to flood their country with corn, subsidized corn from the United States, and put really millions of farmers out of business. And so then, of course, they come across the border, and, of course, people here really want them to come in. They want to convert America into a multicultural, multilingual society. The administration, under the guidance from the Ford Foundation, the other great tax-exempt foundations, which are part of the Brotherhood of Darkness, refuses to enforce the laws of the border or the employer laws, and of course does everything they can to attract them here. So everything seems to work together, and of course the Mexicans are being manipulated. They're simply pawns in a brutal and dangerous game. And I'm sure some of them are drug smugglers, some of them are coyotes, but as Robert says, they're just trying to survive and be able to provide for their families. Well, certainly, you know, as far as the judicial system down there, do they have a trial by jury like we have? Do they have a right of habeas corpus? Do you have any appeal to, you know, suddenly being just thrown into prison and left there until the judge gets back from vacation?
You know, that's a good question. I think, I truly think the things that I did or the mistake that I made was probably not as big as a trial by jury. And, you know, maybe it was my ignorance, but I kept thinking, well, this is, you know, sooner or later I'm going to say I'm sorry and I'm going to get out. And so I really think that, you know, having a judge review this was probably the most appropriate based upon, you know, the level of severity. It was a simple mistake. And
Tell me about the car that you had to give to the judge. What sort of car was it? How old was it? What make?
It was a 93 Mazda Protege, and I had the car, I had paid it off, and you know, it was my first car out of college, and I was kind of excited about a first car out of college, and I had it for a couple of years, and it was a loyal car, and eventually they said, well, you gotta, we want to give it up. And so when I finally was released, I actually went down about a week afterwards, and I said, hey, I've been released, can I get my car back? And the Border Patrol said, no, it's still here. And so I did clean it out and, you know, said goodbye to it.
All right, we'll be back in just a moment here at Radio Liberty. Well, this is Dr. Stan back here at Radio Liberty. Our guest is Robert Messick, and his book is Bullets at the Border, Bullets at the Border. And what happened to him when he had some bullets in the back of his car and got picked up by the Mexican police? Now, of course, it's entirely different if you get into going to Canada from the United States. It's, their laws are the same, the language is the same, and certainly they have a much more, I believe, honest legal system. They're very much designed on the British tradition of the right of habeas corpus and the right to trial by jury and those things. But so much of the legal protections we have here in the United States do not exist in Mexico today. How do you feel about going back to Mexico? Do you have any desire to go back there, maybe, to see the beautiful beaches or enjoy the tourist attractions?
Actually, I have gone back into Mexico. When I was released, I knew that I was, you know, released okay to, you know, go back to America or go back to the United States. And a couple years later, I went actually to Tijuana with a humanitarian service project. And, you know, imagine, you know, 5 busloads of people driving from San Diego into Tijuana. The Mexican Border Patrol knows that, you know, you've got tourist buses going quite often. And so I didn't have a challenge going back into Mexico. Politically, it was more mental. It was, you know, I'd made a mistake and, you know, I'd created all of these stories around, you know, this experience. And now for me to just cross the border for even a service project, it was valuable for me to do that. You know, knowing that, if I get knocked off the horse, I'll get back on again. And so I'm planning on, you know, coming back again. You probably with a family that knows we're all tourists rather than by myself.
All right, fine. Well, I think it's certainly it was a very, very interesting experience. Why did you write the book? What was your goal and objective?
You know, I began telling the tale to a couple of friends, and it basically was coworkers. Hey, you know, where have you been? And you know, I'd say, well, I was 9 days in the Mexican jail, and they said, no way, tell us about it. And so after, you know, telling friends and family, they said, you know, this is funny enough to write a book about it. And so I actually decided to write the story for my posterity. You know, it would be a good, fun story for Grandpa to tell, or, you know, Grandpa to read to, you know, grandkids, you know, 20, 40 years from now. But after it kind of escalated, I knew that I had a message around this that said that it was worth, you know, the current publishing currently. And it's kind of just escalated from there.
All right, hold that thought. We'll be back in just a moment here. Well, this is Dr. Stan. Our guest is Robert Messick, and we're talking about his book, Bullets at the Border. And, of course, Robert was picked up by the Mexican police, got into the Mexican police system. And so before we go on, Robert, would you like to get your website out? Would you like to tell people how they can get copies of your book?
Yeah. The website is the name of the book. It's Bullets at the Border, attheborder.com. And if you go on and place an order through that website, I'll be able to sign it and I can personally autograph it. The books are also sold online. Amazon.com has them. Barnes & Noble has them. And various kind of bookstores will have them as well.
All right, fine. Of course, it's a very interesting read, and basically you sort of identify yourself with Robert because he suddenly goes from one bad situation to another, and the frustration that's there over the 9 days that he's in the Mexican prison. Now, what is the ultimate message that you wanted to get out through this book? And incidentally, I will put out our telephone number if anybody would like to call. Our telephone number is 1-888-24-LIBERTY, 1-888-24-LIBERTY, or 464-8295. But what is the message you'd like to give to your readers?
You know, that's a good question, and I've been asked that a couple of times. Why write a book about such a negative experience? And the two thoughts behind it is, it was, for me, it was a liberating experience, knowing that I could actually announce this, knowing that, you know, I got in trouble and the world will still revolve, and it still will rotate. The second idea behind it is that a lot of people ask themselves why bad things will happen to, you know, good people. And, you know, for me it was a situation. I was a good, clean-cut young man just out of college, and why did this happen to me? And a lot of people will go sideways or go, get upset around their circumstances. But the answer that I really have is that sooner or later, a bad experience will happen to just about everybody. And if we know that these things will happen, we're going to ask ourselves, so what are we going to make of it? And truly it's to test us, to try us, to make us stronger. And if we truly step up into this situation rather than, you know, hide from it, then we can be better people from it.
Well, do you think you enjoy being an American and enjoying the freedoms that we do more after having had this experience?
Yes. I think I took a lot of my personal liberties and personal freedoms for granted. And so because of it, what Mark Twain once said, that prejudice is easily diminished when you travel abroad. And I truly think that, you know, I respect and admire a lot of cultures, as well as, you know, the people and places in Mexico, and I truly am grateful that I'm, you know, a citizen of the United States. And I think, you know, we take a lot of things for granted. And when you are stripped away from your liberty and placed in a jail, then you realize what you actually had when you don't have anything more.
And of course, the thing is that most Americans say we could never lose our freedom; it just couldn't happen here. But they've forgotten, the history of so many of the things that have happened, both, you know, starting really with the Whiskey Rebellion back in 1791, and then of course the Civil War, and the Americans put in concentration camps because they wouldn't serve, and then the brutalization of the people of the South by the American military, and they brought about the Posse Comitatus Act. They've forgotten that they rounded up American citizens during the Second World War, 120,000 Japanese and hundreds of Italians and Germans, seized their property and put them in concentration camps, and they never got their property back. And they had got out of prison at the end of the war, but they were in concentration camps for absolutely no reason. And of course, people have forgotten about the Palmer Raids in 1919 and 1921, when the Attorney General of the United States and Sidney J. Edgar Hoover rounded up 16,000 Americans. Their crime, well, they had subversive thought. They didn't agree with the government. They didn't agree with our going into World War I. And they were branded as being subversives, and they were arrested and put in prison. And of course, in our talk, in our new catalog, syllabus on the planned police state, you'll find so much of the history that the average American has never thought of. Well, Sidney, do you think that as a result of your time in prison down there in Mexico, Robert, that you're going to be more active in America and trying to preserve your freedom, or are you just going to go back to, as most people do, say, it couldn't happen here, I'm just going to lead the good life and enjoy the good life?
That's a good question. What am I going to do with this going forward? I think I'm a lot more knowledgeable around the liberties that I have, especially since, you know, 9/11 has happened. A lot of things, international border policies have changed drastically, and so will that stop me from traveling internationally? No, it'll actually get me more educated when I do so. I think the challenge that I have was I couldn't connect and I couldn't communicate with those people that I was in trouble with. And I think that I'll be more knowledgeable about communicating and connecting with people when, you know, things go bad.
Well, of course, the thing is that, of course, you had your father there, and fortunately he had the enough money, at least, that he was able to hire a lawyer, and they could represent you within the system, and they knew how the system works. You simply bribe the judge. That's how it's done. Of course, here in the United States, it goes on all the time. Back in Washington, D.C., oh, they don't actually give bribes. They just give large sums of money to the re-election campaigns of the certainly of the congressman back there, or the federal government, the administration. They want the congressman to vote a certain way. They offer to put in a $1 billion development in their home district, which would make them very popular. But, of course, it is corrupt. It's just as corrupt as they have in Mexico, where only we're much more refined here in the United States. And we don't call it bribes. We just call it, well, you know, at least in Mexico, everybody knows it's a bribe. Here, they just call it politics.
Yeah. That made a good thought. One of the stories that I have is on the very last day that I was there, another gringo actually came into the jail, and he was an older man, and he was living in Mexico in a community, and gave a ride to a couple of Mexicans, and the federales pulled him over, and as soon as the federales pulled him over, the Mexicans ran, leaving a backpack in their car. So the federales saw this, you know, two guys jump in a car and taking off, but the driver's sticking around because this, you know, older man didn't know what was going on, and the federales found that the backpack had a backpack full of marijuana. And so he got in trouble with it, and he got sent back into the jail. He asked me, he says, what are the lawyers doing for you? And I told him I had to hire these lawyers. And he was in a different financial situation, and he was stuck for a little while. And more than likely, the other jailers said that if you didn't have money and if you didn't have a lawyer to represent you, sooner or later you would kind of do your time. And doing your time in either a week or a month or whatever time frame, and then you'd be released. So it was either, you know, pay the fine now or do your time.
In other words, that's what you were speaking of.
Yeah.
And, of course, what happened to this other gringo, this other older American who was living down there?
As I mentioned, he wasn't in a financial situation. He said, well, I don't think I can hire these lawyers. And I said, well, talk to them and see what they can do for you. And they, you know, eventually... I left, and I don't know what the situation was, but I think that probably he had to wait it out just a little bit longer than I had.
Well, because the thing is that the police are working in many instances. The military is working with the drug smugglers. Maybe they just don't like competition. I mean, because certainly there would not be the drugs that are coming into this country if the Mexican police force and the Mexican army were doing their job. And, of course, the drugs are coming, you know, into this country through Mexico, and all you have to do is pay off the police officers, pay off the judges, pay off the military, I think everybody working down on the border knows that, and suddenly the people are just bringing the drugs into this country and swamping us with drugs, and of course, we're not doing anything at all about it. In fact, we want to do away with all the restrictions at the border and let the free flow of trade go across the border, which will be the free flow of drugs, and I'm really very concerned about that. Are you?
Yeah, it's you know, the what they say, what we fight actually grows bigger, and I'm not sure the resolution. Obviously, I actually feel sorry for the Border Patrol, because especially in, you know, consider airports. You know, if you stop and inspect somebody that looks suspicious, you're racial profiling, or if you stop and, you know, inspect something that somebody that's not suspicious, you're harassing. And so, you know, they got a big plate, and I'm not sure the resolution around it.
Do you think, of course, that the people in Mexico understand this plan that is being implemented by the leaders of Mexico, certainly our president and the premier up in Canada, to join the three countries together, the North American Union? Do they talk at all about that? Are they even aware of it down there, that what really the future holds?
I don't think they're aware of it. I think most of their focus is on a smaller, short-term basis.
And
what are they going to do next week for food? What are they going to do next week for work? How do they, you know, bless the lives of their family on the short term?
And I think a lot of these people in Mexico are really concerned about just survival. I mean, it's a tough life down there. Certainly, if you're a farmer, it's a hard life. If you're working in society, unless you have an education, why, it's very, very difficult. And certainly the wage levels are very, very low compared with ours, which is, of course, why the people want to come up here and why our leaders want them to come up, because that way they can get people to work for lower wages and then drive the wage level down in America, because the ultimate plan, of course, is laid out in the Earth Charter, and that is, of course, to lower the living standard in the United States. Well, our telephone number is 1-888-24-LIBERTY. 1-888-24-LIBERTY, or here in the Central Coast of California at 464-8295. That's 464-8295. If you have a question or comment for Robert Messick, who wrote the book Bullets at the Border, why, of course, give us a call. And you say your book is available. Is it available at Borders or in Barnes & Noble, or most people would get it off your website, which is www.bulletsattheborder.com. How would the easiest way be for people to get the book?
You know, people can go to the bulletsattheborder.com website. As I mentioned, if they order the book there, I'll sign it personally and send it out to them. Or, you know, there's a national database that has books available, and I believe that Barnes & Noble, Borders, and all of the major bookstores have access to, you know, getting a book very quickly. Amazon.com has an order for it as well. So it's available for most people. You brought up an interesting comment, and I wanted to follow up with it. One of the awarenesses that I had was actually the influence of the United States back into America. And the jail that I was in had a TV, and they actually had a VCR, and probably some family member passed it through, or the jailers allowed it. And periodically they would get movies and or watch TV, whatever the radio, whatever the TV antenna would pick up. And it was amazing how much U.S. influence had on TV even down there. I remember we were watching a movie, and it was some military-type movie, and it was all in English, and there were Spanish subtitles. And so I enjoyed the movie. I could just watch it and listen while the other people were reading it. And it was about some military, and they had a close-up shot of some guy holding a handgun. And I elbowed some guy. I said, "That's my gun in back in America." And he says, "Really? That's your, that's your style of gun?" And I said, "Yeah." They had a, good laugh around that. I had the same gun that was in a movie.
Well, I think that one message I got, reading your book, was that people are people, and most people are good people, and most people are just trying to help one another. And of course, you talk there about, then they have, when they come in, they're going to clean up the cell, and everybody gets in together to shake the blankets out, and you help other people shake their blankets, and other people shake your blankets, except at one point they got a little vigorous and they tore your mother's green blanket right in two.
I had an old blanket, and when my dad found me, he gave me a couple of sets of blankets from his car, and one of them was an old kind of, not an heirloom blanket, but it had been in the family a little while, and we decided to do a cleaning, and everyone kind of got everything out of the, from under the bunk beds and shook out blankets, and you'd imagine all of the dust that came out, in the jail, and some guy, two of them took my blankets, and they just pulled at the same time and ripped right down the middle. So just imagine me having to explain to my mom that some blanket got ripped in a Mexican jail.
Well, of course, now, basically, did they provide blankets for the people there, or did people have to bring their own blankets, just as the church had to supply the food?
Most of them had their own blankets.
Most people have to bring their own blankets to prison.
That's right. More than likely, the families brought clothes over and brought blankets over. I remember I had an extra blanket, and one of them had just like a 4-foot by 4-foot lap blanket. And so I gave them, my blanket, and, it didn't bother me at all that there's plenty to be passed around, but all of them did have their own supply of blankets.
And of course, unlike, of course, what we have in American jails, where everything is provided by the jail, mm-hmm. there, of course, they have to cook their own food, the church has to bring in the food, people have to bring in their blankets. People have no idea of the difference between our society and other societies. I know when I lived in Africa for 3 years, You know, it's a whole different world than it is here in the United States, and certainly it's far more civilized than Mexico, but still so entirely different. And yet, the one experience that I brought back with me is that it didn't matter whether you were black or whether you were colored or whether you were white in South Africa. All people were good, and most of them were working with one another and helping one another. And I was the chief surgeon in a black hospital, chief orthopedic surgeon, and had 80 beds and half a dozen doctors in training. But and it was a black hospital where I worked, and yet, you know, and the only whites there were the doctors, and because they couldn't put any blacks in the hospitals, because if you came from one tribe, why, none of the nurses would take your orders. And there was such tremendous racial animosity of black on black, but no animosity towards me as a white man. It was the most wonderful experience. We were there during the Soweto riots, but that's another story for another time. But I think that as I read Robert's book, Bullets to the Border, the message he has is that the Mexican people are good, and they were helpful, and they really had empathy for him being there, especially that it would appear that it was all a mistake, whereas many of them, of course, were there for very real crimes that they'd committed. So, you know, it's a book in many respects that makes you sort of feel good. Have you heard that sort of a comment from other people who've read it, Robert?
Yeah, I've had a lot of comments that it is truly inspiring, knowing that, you know, people make mistakes in their lives, but also the bigger lesson learned is, so what are we going to make of them?
And there is redemption. Well, we'll be back in just a moment to wrap up today's program here at Radio Liberty. Well, Robert, you've got 3 minutes to wrap up the program. What message would you like to leave with our listeners here in the Monterey Bay area and all across America?
You know, that's a good question. And, you know, what would I want a reader to know if they read my book or afterwards would be that there is a message of hope, that no matter our circumstances, we are better than our circumstances, that truly we can step up into, you know, whatever we need to do and accomplish it. Also, I think, you know, internationally, it's interesting when we talk internationally around the blessings that we have in the United States compared to other places. And I know that if I do travel, it gives me an opportunity to be more educated, as well as, you know, my advice to other people if they're traveling is to just take a little bit of time to educate themselves and prepare themselves for a culture shock around whatever they're going to expect or whatever they're going to receive in a different country.
And, of course, really, of course, the real frustrating thing is, of course, when the average tourist goes to Mexico, he's going to go to tourist centers, and most people are going to speak English or be fairly fluent in it. But here you're thrown into a situation where most people certainly don't speak English, certainly the guards, the people you're coming in contact with, a few of them do, but you're there, and you can't understand them, and they can't understand you, and doesn't that lead to quite a bit of frustration?
It did, and literally I could not say, I'm sorry, I didn't have no trouble, I didn't want any trouble, you know, please forgive me, here, take my bullets away, I didn't have any problem, you know, I didn't have the intention of doing any harm, and that was just because I didn't have the vocabulary to connect with them or communicate with them.
All right, fine. Well, of course, do you have any plans for another book at the present time, or are you just going to retire from writing for the time being?
You know, the momentum for this book is going pretty well. There's obviously the book was written when I was in Arizona, and there's momentum there around it. So for the time being, I'm very happy with this until it goes even further. So I'm gonna ride this a little while.
All right, fine. Well, I guess it's been Robert Messick, his book, Bullets at the Border, and of course it's available by calling going on the internet at going to www.bulletsattheborder.com, bulletsattheborder.com, and of course Robert's mistake was he had a box of bullets in the car. You could do that here in the United States, wouldn't be a problem, but you go into Mexico, it's a whole different world. Robert, thank you very much for being with us. God bless, and the best of luck to you.
Thank you, Dr. Stan. Appreciate it.
Bye-bye. Well, this is Dr. Stan. I hope you enjoyed our program this afternoon, a little different than most of our programs, but of course there's a message to be learned, and that is that we still have a wonderful, wonderful country here. Isn't it a shame we're losing it? We're losing it because the good people are not involved in the process, and they do not understand the dark spiritual forces that are aligned against freedom. And that's why we put together this talk on the planned police state, and we put together a great syllabus, which we hope you'll want to get. But, of course, the one thing, of course, we can talk about all the things that are going on, whether it be the concentration camps in America. Yes, ladies and gentlemen, there really are concentration camps. They're all there. There's nobody in them at the present time. They're refurbishing the old Japanese concentration camps. They're using the old military bases. They've simply changed them around. So now, of course, the barbed wire is not to keep people out, but to keep people in. And then, of course, they've given $385 million to KBR, that's Kellogg, Brown, and Root, which is a subdivision of Halliburton, which, of course, is Dick Cheney's old company. And, of course, they are standing by to be ready to build the concentration camps. And there really is a plan, and you can actually hear on my talk a clip from Congressman Henry Gonzalez, who says there really is a plan in case of a national emergency to suspend the Constitution, round people up and put them into concentration camps. Now, most Americans say it could never happen here. Well, that's exactly what the Jews said in Germany. That's what the Christians said in Germany. And of course, the tragedy was that any Christian who took a stand against Adolf Hitler ended up, of course, being taken to a prison camp. And what we never tell the American people is that 12 million Christians, predominantly Christians, died, as well as the Jews who died there. And we never talk about that. You can look at that in War and for Genocide, a book that was written by a Jewish scholar, Jewish professor, I think it was Norman Cohn. But War and for Genocide, and talked about the 12 million others who died. And of course, since this was predominantly a Christian nation, why these were predominantly Christians, but we never talk about persecution of Christians any more than we talk about the murder of Christians in Armenia, and certainly the murder of Christians in Rwanda, and the murder of Christians in Nagasaki. It was bombed. It was the most Christianized city in all of Japan. The Japanese have been trying to surrender for 6 months, and if you doubt that, we actually have the article that appeared in the Chicago Tribune on the 15th of August, 1945, where, of course, the article tells how the Japanese have been trying to surrender and we wouldn't, and then we slaughtered all those Christians there in Nagasaki. Why would they have done that? Why would they have bombed a civilian city, the most Christianized city in Japan? Well, ladies and gentlemen, if you'd like, of course, to get that article, our telephone number, 1-800-544-8927. If I could suggest my talk on Iraq, the Untold Story, that's Iraq, the Untold Story, because it comes with a great syllabus that, of course, has the documentation on so much of what we talk about. All of the wars have been contrived. Certainly Vietnam was a no-win war. Korea was a no-win war. We sent the boys into the Bay of Pigs to die, the Cuban nationals who wanted to retake their country. And, of course, we couldn't let them know that we'd brought Fidel Castro to power knowing he was a communist. If you haven't seen my DVD on World Revolution, which includes my interview with the American ambassador to Cuba, at the time of the revolution, he will tell you, we knew it. Fidel Castro was a communist. We brought him to power. The CIA brought him to power. But we got to make the American people think that Fidel Castro is the enemy. That DVD is, of course, The World Revolution. I recommend it to you. And then, of course, my talk on Iraq, the Untold Story, and the syllabus that comes with it. And if you'd like to see that that article from the Chicago Tribune that tells about how the Japanese have been trying to surrender and we wouldn't let them. Why wouldn't we let them surrender? Why? Because we were going to bomb Nagasaki and kill all those Christians. And why would anybody do that? Because we're facing organized evil, ladies and gentlemen. There really are people who worship a different God. And, of course, you'll learn about that in my talk on the planned police state, in my talk on the forbidden secret, and my book, The Brotherhood of Darkness, Pray for America, but please pray for Radio Liberty.
You're listening to the Global Star Radio Network, located at Telstar 5 KU band, frequency 11836, symbol rate 20770. Thank you for listening.